Okay, so last week we kind of did some high-level fundamentals, and as we said, the first part of the semester is going to be mostly theory, kind of the basics, and then, like I said, the second half we're going to talk more about how it applies to how your practice works, the more business side, but still the law coming in. And today we're going to talk about contracts. Actually, for the next 2 weeks, we're going to talk about contracts. As we talked about last week, in the law for claims, we went through what a claim is. There's basically two areas you're going to have claims. There's going to be contracts and torts, torts being an injury or some type of taking. So it could be conversion, which is the civil way of saying theft. It could be trespass or what have you. That's much less common in the construction world. The most times when you come up with a tort, is there's going to be a work or injury on the project. Occasionally you might have where a wall falls down and it damages the neighbor's property, and so that would be a tort on their property because there's no contract between the architect or the contractor and the neighbor. So if you have to have some way for the neighbor to recover, they would recover in tort. We will talk about torts in a lecture a little bit later on this first half, but it's not going to be as important as contracts. We're going to talk about contracts quite a bit because that's how you guys figure out what you're going to be doing, and that's going to be most of the claims if they come up. It's also going to be important because in the business world, you just got to have the rules of how to play Monopoly. I mean, that's the way I look at it, is if you're going to play a board game, you need to know the rules. If you're going to play a card game, you need to know the rules. If you're going to be into building or designing something, you need to know the rules, and the rules are going to be spelled out in a contract. So that's what we're going to do. We're going to talk about the law and how we form contracts and interpretation of them. You want to think about contracts. For the first part, we're going to get into different formations later in the semester. But for the basic right now, everybody think about a triangle. We talked about this a little last week. At the top of the triangle, you're going to have the owner. And at the two corners, you're going to have the architect and you're going to have the contractor. There's going to be that solid line between the owner and the contractor and the owner and the architect. Those solid lines represent a contract because there is a direct connection between the two. On the bottom, you have the architect and the contractor. That's a dotted line because there are no direct obligations owed from the architect to the contractor or the contractor to the architect. But they have to communicate and they have to work together. That's why you think about the base of that contract as dotted lines as opposed to triangle. Now, if you want to take, and we'll get into this, but you don't have to worry about for today's lecture, if you want to take that contract and shift it up a little bit higher, on these two basic corners, you're going to have then little lines going down, and that's going to be your civil engineer, your structural engineer, your mechanical engineer, your lighting company. They're going to be in contract with the architect. And under the contractor, you're going to have the lines going down for your plumber, your electrician, your carpenter, your finished carpenter, your drywaller. So that's how the structure will look. We're going to get into that much more later on when we get into styles of contracts and everything else, but I just want to give you that basic, because throughout the semester I'm going to say, remember the triangle. So, okay. So contract law, formation, and interpretation. So we're going to start out with a theory of contracts. So a contract, it's really basic stuff, but it's really simple. A contract is an agreement between two or more parties that is enforceable under the law. So the law is going to say which type of contracts are enforceable or not. And the important thing you got to remember here is it's between two or more parties. A lot of times you're going to have the owner and the architect or the owner and the contractor. But I've had cases where the owner may have multiple parties. So like I represented a contractor who was in contract with a gentleman initially that owned a strip mall. We were going to be doing construction for the rebuilding of the strip mall. Well, he then assigned a portion of his contract to his daughter because he was creating generational wealth. So she was ultimately going to be owning the strip mall. So there were two owners and one contractor. And there can be multiple. It can be sometimes in a contract structure, you can have multi-prime, you can have one owner and multiple contractors. You can have like a owner that wants to deal with all the contractors as opposed to subs. So it's not just two parties, it's two or more parties that have an agreement together. The purpose, and we talked a little bit about this last week too, is to tie down the future. You want predictability. The law is about predictability and safety and taking care of the people. And if you know about what's going to happen and you have predictability, then you're going to have safety. And you're going to follow the law. And the one thing you want to think about, again, is the contract. Like I keep saying in our references, it's because I think it's the easiest one for everybody to kind of remember. It's like a board game. It's like Monopoly. It's the rules. Now, we did talk about this a little last week. A contract for a construction project, if you think about it, You could never have every single thing in that contract. You can't have how to hammer a nail or what torque wrench you're supposed to be. Every single thing couldn't be in that written contract. It would be massive. And so it's going to be a combination. It'll have the drawings and specifications, but still there are going to be some things that are interpreted by custom and practice. If you remember that hierarchy last week, the very bottom was industry custom and practice, what everybody remembers, what they all do. We all know an electrician is going to do its type of work, and the plumber is going to do its type of work. And so some of the things that the plumber is going to do and how they do it, or the electrician how they're going to do it, is not actually written in the contract. What it'll say is it'll say that the subcontractor, the plumber, must conform to industry standards and those types of things. So it still is a written document that ties down, well, it can be oral too, but it ties down with the predictability of the future. And then the last point that's really important on this page here is it talks about a bargain or a trade. I will design this house for you. You will pay me $10,000. That's a bargain and a trade. There needs to be, both sides need to have fulfilled some type of, or have an obligation to fulfill some type of piece of the puzzle, piece of the contract. You also need, what I have here, the meeting of the minds. What you don't want to have, what can happen with contracts, and this is where the lawyers get involved, is where you believe that you only have to pay me if I do A, B, and C. And I believe that I can do whatever I want to design in that house, and you must pay me. Now, we both know that there's a house being designed. We both know that there's $10,000. So there's an obligation for me to design a house, and there's an obligation for you to pay me $10,000. That might not be a meeting of the minds. You may say, I needed you to do all these things, and I just thought I had to design a house, and maybe I didn't do A, B, and C. If there's no meeting of the minds of the terms of the agreement, then there's no contract. And we'll talk about whether it's void or invalid, and we'll get into those types of things. So you need to have that meeting of the minds. Now, the point of why you write contracts in written documents as opposed to oral, although oral contracts happen all the time, but as a lawyer, I'm going to tell you, always write it down, is so the parties then can't later come back and say, this is what I thought it meant. No, I thought it meant that. Because someone can get out of their obligations by changing the terms and saying, I never understood that. But if it's in writing, you have that to be able to say, here's what it says, this was our meeting of the minds. So it's very important in the formation of an initial contract. Any questions on that? Now, the other thing you want to do is sometimes, and this is, I will confess to you, you guys might not know these two gentlemen that are going to come up on the screen, but I always play anyway because it's a little bit humorous. But sometimes you need to break down what the contract is and who the parties are. So hopefully this works through the speakers here. I don't know, but we'll find out. So does anybody know who these guys are? There you go. So, like I said, I'm a little bit older, obviously. These are guys that were very, very popular in the 40s and 50s, obviously even before I was around. But they used to do a lot of shtick and stand-up. But I found this many years ago talking about contracts. And part of the point here is that's how confusing contracts can get. When you start writing on the legalese, and so what I talked about last week is I want to try to get rid of this concept of the party of the first party, second party, party of the second party, things like that. But it is important to know, if we go back to that very first slide for today, is who are the parties in the contract? And that's why, again, so there's a meeting of the minds. The case that I handled where there was the lawsuit filed by the owner of the strip mall and his daughter was involved, well, what ended up happening was, is he made this assignment where he gives a portion of the obligations to his daughter, and there was problems with both he was suing us for construction issues as well as the architect and some other parties. There was many of us in the case. But he hadn't made payments. And he was trying to shuffle those payment obligations off to his daughter, of which we didn't know about the assignment. So we got into issues, even questions, of the meeting of the minds of who the parties were that should have been in the lawsuit. We ended up sorting it out, and there's over the semester I'll kind of give you more pieces in what happened in that case. It was very successful for our client, which was nice, and the other parties. But it's important when you get that meeting of the minds so you don't end up with this confusion. So... okay, so we have these very basic structures. Multiple parties, you need a meeting of the minds. It's better if it's written in oral, but it can be both. And your reason to do it is for predictability. So now let's talk about the types of contracts that you're going to see. Now, these are going to be in construction, but these are contracts that you're going to see in any type of business thing. So if any of you guys get out and you practice architecture for a little bit, you decide you're going to go somewhere else and you run a business, these will come up as well. So again, this is basic theory. It's not just construction contracts that are going to have that. Now, the express contract is the most common kind of contract you're going to have. Express contract sounds just like it is. It expresses what the party's intents are. Okay? They're going to be both written and oral. So you don't have to have everything in writing. You can have an agreement. Now, what's interesting, and we'll talk about this throughout the semester as well, it'll come up in probably on your exam, is you're going to see contracts. You may have even seen these in something you guys have done now. I don't know if anybody's bought a car or rented an apartment or whatever. And if you read through the legalese, sometimes it'll say that this contract can only be modified by something in writing. And so that's a term, that's the rule of the contract. Here's an interesting thing that people don't understand. If both parties agree that they can orally modify that contract, that oral modification modifies the contract because you have a subsequent agreement between the parties. So even though the writing says, it's only one area where it deviates from the writing, but even though the writing says in order to modify this contract, you must do it in writing, if the same two parties later say, I will orally modify the contract, and they come to an agreement on what that modification is, now you have a modified contract, even though it says you can't do it. That's a little bit of a nuance, but it's an express agreement between the parties. We expressly agree. We are clear. We have a meeting of the minds. Let's give it as an example. You're paying $1,000 a month for rent. Says this contract isn't going to be modified unless there's a written writing, so your rent would go up to $1,200 a month after you've been there for a year. Turns out that the landlord comes and says, hey, next year the rent's going to go up to $1,200. Are you okay with that? Yeah, I'm fine with that. And it's going to be, is that going to be for the whole next year? Yes, every month it's going to be $1,200. Very clear. Everybody agreed to that. January comes, you're paying $1,000. He says you're only $1,200. And you say, no, I have this written contract that says I owe you $1,000. And he says, but we agreed it was $1,200. You have made an oral agreement to that. You have modified that contract. And if you didn't pay your $1,200 and he took you to court, you would have to pay the $1,200. Unless you lied and said you never had an agreement, which you don't want to do. So, implied contracts, that's the second type of contract we'll talk about throughout the semester. This one here is called implied in fact. Now, it is not necessarily written or oral. But the actions of the parties imply that there's an agreement. How many people here have pets? So a lot of you. But if you haven't had a pet, maybe there's times where you've gone, I'm sure everybody here sometime in their life has gone to a doctor, right? Had to go to a hospital, had to go to a doctor, had to go to a dentist. How many times have you, when you took your pet in, or you went to your doctor or dentist, how many times did you sign a contract that said, if you take care of my dog, I'll pay you your fee, or if you fix my teeth, you clean my teeth, I will pay you a fee. Has anybody ever signed that contract? No. But you know what? If the doctor, if the vet worked on your dog and you refused to pay, or if the dentist fixed your teeth and you refused to pay, they would be able to sue you for what? Breach of contract. But implied in fact contract. It is understood for those types of scenarios that, and it's mostly, you're going to see most of the time implied in fact contracts are going to come up around services like these things. Because you imply that that's going to happen. And everybody understands that. There's another thing, though, where maybe it's not around services, but goods. You go to the store, you buy a bunch of apples, you come home, you cut them open, you pay for the apples, you go to that, that's an implied effect contract right there. If you're going to take and buy food from the grocery store, you have to pay for them. That's an implied effect contract. And you bring them home and you cut open the apples and they have worms. Implied effect that you can bring those back and say, hey, these were bad apples. These were something you didn't give me that I had expected to have something that was a good apple as opposed to bad apples. And you bring them back and the store would have to take them back. Those are for goods. So it doesn't have to be services. It could be for goods. Those are all implied in fact contracts. It's the fact that drives what everybody's kind of used to. Does that make sense? Okay. Now we get into quasi-contracts. This is where it gets a little bit more nuanced and a little harder to understand. Quasi-contract is agreement between two or more parties with no prior obligation to each other, so they don't owe anything to each other. It's imposed even if neither party originally intended to be there to be a contract. And one thing that's important about this quasi-contract, it's implied in law, is that one side was unjustly enriched. Now, what does that mean? I'll give you an example of fixing a leak in a roof. So, let's say that you wanted to have your roof, there was a problem with the roof, and I use this example because it happened to me. So we had a leak in our roof, and we called in a roofer, and he came up and he was doing some fixing of the roof at where it was leaking. He also noticed, and I had worked with this guy before, so I wasn't worried about him taking advantage of me or anything else like that, but he also noticed an area of my roof where the asphalt shingles and everything had been damaged by a storm. We had some trees that came down and damaged and everything else. And he fixed those shingles. And so he came down to me and he said, it's going to be, I don't know, like $1,500, $2,000, whatever it was to fix the roof where it was leaking. I had to repatch it and I had to put in new plywood, blah, 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 blah. He goes, also over on the side of your house here, there were some other things I redid those. And that's going to be another $500. Now, I had a contract with him. We actually had a contract that was in writing for what he was going to be doing, the performance of the work where the leak was. But he went and did something else. So we had an obligation, we didn't have a prior obligation about the other part. There was a clear understanding of what the contract was. But he did other work. I didn't expect him. It wasn't like I walked into a dentist's office or I was buying apples from a store, I was taking my dog to the pet, but to the vet. It was where he on his own did something else that I didn't ask for. Should he be paid for that? Should he say, I'm entitled to my money? And the argument here is that I didn't intend him to go up and just start surveying my whole roof and everything else, but he can make an argument that says, well, we had this quasi-contract that you wanted me to fix your roof, and although it was about this area where the leak was, I saw another potential problem. And you, if you get to keep that, because he could say, well, I'll rip it all up, but if you get to keep those new shingles where the leaks were, but where they were kind of damaged and could be leaking later, I would be unjustly enriched. If I didn't have to pay him the $500 for the additional work, I would get a benefit of his services and his materials. So the law will impose a quasi-contract to that additional work. They may say it's a modification to the original contract. They may say this is a second contract that's a quasi-contract. It's implied in the law. Because the law says, if someone does something for you that could be expected, or maybe is not necessarily expected, but was within the scope and the concepts, they still get paid for their services. Now, you don't want to have this happening a lot. If you think about it in a construction project, I mean, would it be fair if the plumber came in and he started putting in fixtures and he decided, you know what, I don't like the fixtures the architect specified. I'm going to put these other fixtures in, which are twice as expensive. Does the plumber get paid for that? No. Because that's not something that is within the realm and the scope. It's a change of the scope. But my scope with the contractor for my roof was to fix the leak, and he went over and saw something else. So quasi-contracts, like I said, it's nuanced, and this is where the fights will happen in the court of law. When you have a construction project, things change. I mean, you find out that the soil's not good. You find out that whatever happens, there's going to be changes throughout the course of the construction project. And you have to have the balance between can the contractor have new, can they have the ability, the freedom to do things like fix additional part of the roof, or does it always have to be in writing? And how you establish that is what the base contracts are and everything else. You don't want to find yourself in quasi-contract situations, but they do happen more often than you would expect. Another example I always give for this is let's say you're, and it's a little bit different, well, and we'll get to it in a second why, but just for purpose of example, I live in a neighborhood, there's a bunch of kids around that live in the neighborhood. Sometimes they're cutting lawns, and I find out that Tommy across the street has a lawn business. And I'm talking to him, and I'm like, I'm really tired, I'm sick and tired of doing my lawn all the time. Maybe someday I'll have you do the lawn. And then the next week, he cuts my lawn. Is there an implied, in fact, quasi-contract? Can he say, Mr. Hannigan, I thought you said I could go comply with the contract? There could be an argument, he wants $40 for cutting my lawn. There's an argument, was there a meeting of the mind? There's an argument that I'm getting unjustly rich. So sometimes you have to get into those situations of like, what's the real answer? What was the intent? What were the parties' understandings? And that's where this is $40, but if you can imagine a big construction project where there's hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars at issues, that's where the lawyers come in and try to figure out. So, of course, I would pay Tommy across the street the $40 because he's a nice kid and everything else. But the only type of contract that would have been a quasi-contract, because I didn't specifically ask him, nor did I expect him just to come across the street like an implied in fact contract. Yeah, sure, he was cutting some of the neighbor's lawns, but we didn't have any type of agreement. So, questions on that? Yes, first.
Can you, say in an express contract, can you have a certain addition or clause stating that there are no
clauses? Yes, and in fact, that's a great question. So, separate from the concept of, help yourself if you want to go, separate from the concept that you can orally modify a contract where it says it only can be modified in writing, what you're going to find in construction contracts and architectural contracts all the time is it's going to say, if there is additional work to be performed, the contractor must get authorization in writing before performing the work. Now, that's much more specific. Contractor gets up on the roof, fixes the leak, sees the damage. If he does and fixes the damaged shingles where the tree fell on it, but it wasn't leaking, and while written contract says, if before you do more work, you must get written authorization, he doesn't get paid, because now we have a specific rule to the Monopoly Board that he says he must ask for permission. And that's an important clause you want to have in your construction contracts or your architectural contracts to keep someone from trying to inject a quasi-contract or making some type of oral modification that may or may not have existed. Does that help? You had a question too.
Yeah. If my contract isn't going to go under the Highway of Customs
and Practice? Yes. What you want to think about there, though, is it is a custom and practice that when you go to the grocery store, if I'm going to take apples out, I'm going to pay for them. It's a custom and practice. If you go to a vet, you're going to pay for the doctor's services, the vet services to take care of your pet. So yes, that is a custom and practice, and that helps create this implied in fact. It's the custom and practice of the understanding of what's going on in the public life. Remember contracts for predictability and predict future and everything else. We all know that's how the system works. Custom and practice as a term in the construction world, at least, because that's what I practice, has a more defined meaning, though. So you wouldn't say, There's an implied effect contract because I went to the grocery store because it's customary practice to do that. It's, everybody knows what we're going to do. Everybody knows if you get apples, you got to pay for them. That's the kind of, so the custom and practice, and we'll get into this, what's called defined terms in terms of art in construction contracts and any type of contract. Custom and practice, we'll say, it's tied to the industry. So the custom and practice in the industry of what a plumber is expected to do is going to be different than what an electrician is going to do. And so we know what's going on in that industry. But normally where you're going to see the custom and practice concept coming in is an express contract, oral or written, that will say, hey, I want you to follow industry custom and practice. As opposed to saying, when you walk into the vet, you say, hey, are we good on the custom and practice? Is that what we're going to do here? You know, so it's the same concept. You are correct on that question. It is the very same contract. It's just the nuance of the language. And that's where part of the legalese of when, and we'll get into defined terms and stuff like that, but that's where you can understand a little bit of the difference. When you're in any type of negotiation or in your construction world or you're in architecture and they say industry custom practice, it's going to apply to you. And like me as a lawyer, I have industry custom and practice as well. So I have to follow certain model rules. I have to follow what I'm supposed to be doing. And then that's one of the things it says. It's like if I answer a phone call from a stranger and they start asking me legal questions, I start giving him legal advice, I am actually now his lawyer. That's an industry custom and practice. And so that it gets a little more specialized, I guess, in the way to answer that question. Anything else? Okay, two other types of contracts that could apply to all of those. There is a bilateral contract. A bilateral contract involves the exchange of mutual promises or completed performance, or promise the future. It's an exchange, bilateral, two or more parties. I do this for you, you do this for me. Pretty simple. That's most of the contracts are bilateral. Now, even if it's multiple parties, even if it's one party on one side and five parties on the other side, it's still, I do these things for you, you do these things for me. It's that bilateral nature. Both sides have an obligation or a duty. If you remember, we were talking about claims last week. One of the things you have to have for a claim is a duty. So duty applies in both tort and contract, but it's an obligation or a duty to perform something. That's in a bilateral contract. Unilateral contracts are a contest where one party need not do anything. It's only a single party that is going to be giving the promise. Now, what is that type of an example? Well, guys all, I mean, maybe we don't know it or not, but like, the Jewel does it, McDonald's does it, they come out every year, it's the Monopoly game time, where you go in and if you buy some fries and you peel the thing off, you can win $1 million or you can win another pair of fries. Or when you get a cap, you get a Coke and you undo the cap and you look at the bottom and it says you can win something. Or any type of thing like that. Any type where it's a, where you can win something and you don't have to do anything other than, and if you remember, if you know, there's like, they have those, they do the commercial, they talk about all the prizes you're going to win, and then there's a guy or a woman at the end that talks super fast and says, void where prohibited, no participation necessary, blah, 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 blah. That no participation necessary means you don't have to buy the French fries to participate in McDonald's Monopoly game. If you actually get that piece of paper when you go to McDonald's and they explain the Monopoly game, it'll say no participation necessary, meaning if you want to enter into this game, all you have to do is write us. There's going to be an address written, and it's going to say, write us a letter and say, I want to participate, and that counts for the same as one order of fries or one McDonald's, one hamburger. Same thing will happen when you go to the Jewel. If you go that and you just write in. So you don't have to purchase anything. No purchase required for participation. That is a unilateral contract. You can still win something without buying something. If it's the buying things, if you're going to buy French fries and then you can potentially win, that changes it to bilateral. But all of those, or not all of those, but many of those types of games that you see and are going to be a, will have a provision in there to allow for a unilateral contract. Now, why do they do that? Well, McDonald's does it, and Jewel does it, all these things. They do it for marketing. They have this deal with Monopoly. Monopoly gets benefits because it markets their product. People want to go in and win prizes and stuff, so it helps McDonald's on its sales or whoever's going to be doing it. So they want to do that, and they want to do it nationwide. Some states will not allow you to do that game unless you put that unilateral contract provision in there. Some states say you can only have a contest if there's a unilateral provision in there. If not, it's considered gambling. So you have to have that. I'll give you an example of how things that work on the construction project. So I worked on a number of my construction projects. It's very common for this. The contractors want to have safety. And a lot of times, especially in the northern states and the eastern states where there's unions involved, they require not only that you have follow OSHA and different safety rules and everything else, but they require that that they're monitoring. And if there's a certain type of safety violation, there's certain types of potential fines that can come down. And so what you're going to see often at a construction project site, especially a long construction project site, you're going to see a board, and it's going to say 75 days without any incidents. So that also for the company, the contractor's promoting safety. Look, we've gone all throughout, 100 days, 1,000 days, whatever it is without an incident. So it's good for the company. It's good for the unions. It's good for the workers, even if there aren't unions and everything else. That's a good thing. But what ends up happening is sometimes you want to incentivize your workers. And so what we have often found, and I've drafted contracts for these, or drafted provisions in the construction contract, that says, for showing up to work, you get a point. For showing up to work and having a work-free day or an injury-free day, you get another point. So you get 2 points a day. And over the course of your working there, let's say you're 100 days, you get 200 points. If you have every day you're fine and every day you don't get an injury, and every quarter or every 6 months or every year, depending on the project, your points are going to go into a bucket. So this is the God's honest truth. I had a project where we had a project out in north of Baltimore. It was a power plant. There was, on the average, there was about 1,300 workers on the project. It was a $450 million project. So a lot of workers, took 3 years to build. So there's a lot of people building up points and everything else. Every quarter they gave away something. And at the end of the year, which was the big prize, they gave away big prizes. Like, and you literally just draw the name out of the bucket. It's like a raffle. But you didn't have to do anything other than show up and be injury free. Well, you had to show up anyway. That was your job. And hopefully you didn't want to have an injury, so you got that out. So you were not doing anything in the contract, but the company, the general contractor, was unilaterally providing prizes if you got your name pulled out of the hat. They gave away motorcycles. They gave away a $40,000 car one time because there was so much money being made on the project and everything. So some of these prizes are actually pretty nice. All of that, unilateral contracts. And we had to write it properly because when we were out in Baltimore, Maryland had laws about how you could do that because they didn't want it to be gambling. Because you know, you draw out a lottery, it could be like I'm playing bingo. That could be gambling. But it's not if you write the provision properly. That's a unilateral contract. Make sense? Okay. You will not see a lot of unilateral contracts in the concept of construction, but it's the basic that I just want you guys to know. Okay, now, contracts, as whether they're valid or not. And one of the things we'll talk about, whether it's void or voidable and unenforceable, has to do with the law. That's why I had to do some writing out in Baltimore, Maryland, to make sure we complied with the law. So you have a valid contract. Valid contract is two or more parties, duly to mind, and it's legal. Everything's fine. We have a valid contract. That's the majority of what you want your contracts to be. However, you could have a void contract. A void contract is not legally enforceable at any point. Even if the way the terms of the contract are written follow the law, even if the terms are black and white, even if the parties are known, and even if the parties agreed with each other, had a meeting of the minds, all of those provisions that created a valid contract, it could be void. And you're like, well, how did that happen? How can you have a void contract if everything is right? Can't have contracts with the minors. Can't have contracts with someone who is mentally incapacitated. You can't have contracts if someone has lied to you. So that may not be a meeting of the minds, but if it's with a minor, if it's against public policy, that could be void. If against the law, but you don't know that, it could be void. So a valid contract could be void because it's never enforceable. So, the example that I give is like against public policy. You have to kind of shift over to organized crime for that concept. You hire a hitman, or you hire somebody to go break somebody's kneecaps. You have an agreement between the parties. We know who, Lenny, you're going to go out and you're going to take out Sammy's knees. And I'm going to pay you $10,000 for that. And it has to be done before midnight on Friday. And we all know who it is and everything else. Well, harming someone is against the law. It's also against public policy, too. So even though they had this agreement, I'm going to pay $10,000, Lenny, for taking out Sammy's knees, if I don't want to pay the $10,000, I don't have to, because there is no contract. It is a void contract. There never could have been a contract. Now, of course, if we're getting into those concepts of the unseen nature of people, you don't want to necessarily not pay on those things and how the organized crime might work. They have their own laws and how they enforce those laws. Money's going to get somebody else to come after me. But the point being is that contract, as even though all the terms are considered valid, it's a void contract. If I make that contract with Tommy from across the street to cut my lawn for $40, it's not a valid contract. It sounds like a valid contract, but it's a void contract because they are a minor. Okay? Next one. Voidable contract. Okay, a voidable contract, it seems like it's valid and legal until something happens and then you can void it. And what is the things that can have a contract being void or canceled? Well, if I withheld information, I didn't tell you, let's say we'll take in the construction terms. I want you to design me a house. You're going to pay for, or you know, I have designs for this house. I have the designs the architect has given to me. I'm hiring you as a contractor to build it. I want you to build this house. Here's the property where it's going to be. We all know how much it's going to cost to build. We all know the property. We all know the parties. There's nothing illegal about that. No big problem, right? But what happens if the property is only zoned for commercial or industrial, not residential? And I start building on it, and I start putting in time and work and everything else, and then sometimes, during the course of our construction, the village comes out and shuts my project down because I'm building a house. I didn't have a proper permit. Well, I didn't know that. You withheld that information from me. That creates a contract that can be voided. If there's undue influence, if I force, hey, if you don't do this to me, I'm going to do something else. I'm going to withhold. Let's say we have a contract, we're exchanging goods and services. Now I want another contract, and I want to have a better deal. Well, your business, is the lifeblood is our original contract, which we'll be doing back and forth. Now I'm forcing you to the second contract with undue influence, saying, I'm going to cancel this contract, our good one, if you don't do this for the cheaper amount. That's a voidable contract. The terms may seem to be proper, but the undue influence of forcing them to do that makes the contract that is valid voidable or cancelable. Cancellation. Mutual mistake. We didn't come to a meeting of the minds. A minor can void a contract. Hey, you know what? I don't have to cut your lawn because I'm a minor. So you think it was valid, but it's now voidable. So, an example I have for this one is the voidable contract I had. I represented a client that had bought a house in a subdivision. It was at the bottom of the subdivision was kind of built on a sloping area, and they were at the bottom. And they were in a cul-de-sac, and then somewhere off, kind of further over, was a retention pond for the stormwater to run into. Well, the contractor, in working with their civil engineer, didn't properly handle the sewer for the runoff. So by the time it got to the bottom of the hill in that cul-de-sac, that would flood, and the basement flooded. And so when my client came in and bought the house, within a number of months, their basement flooded, and it flooded, and it flooded. We went in and canceled that contract. It was a sale of a house. It was a legal sale. We loved that. My client loved the house. It was beautiful. They loved the area where they wanted to live. There was a mortgage put in, everything, the closing. They moved in, blah, blah, blah. Seems everything fine. But what they didn't know was that the fact that this problem with the sewage and the water and their basement flooded. So they weren't getting the deal that they thought. There was a mutual mistake and maybe even a misrepresentation. So we ended up, what's called rescission. We rescinded the contract and it canceled. And we got all our money, I got all the money back to the client and they moved. So that's something where you can add a valid contract, but you voided it. Unenforceable contracts is different than a voided contract. Now, the voided contracts, not legally valid ever. And an enforceable contract is something that can't be enforced in a court of law. It could have been a valid contract, but by the time you get to court about it, it's unenforceable. So we have some examples like duress, fraud. Those are the ones that we talk about where you have this valid contract, but then you find something out, and the law says you can't defraud someone. So you go to court and you go ahead and you have that contract and make it, you can't enforce that contract. If it's unconscionable, safety, or unfair, that was some another way, another theory. A lot of times you use similar theories like, when we went in on this lawsuit that we had over this house that had the leaky basement, we had both theories. We said this contract can be voided, and we said it's unenforceable in the law, because we said that you defrauded us on what happened with the water coming in. It wasn't safe for us. We had a couple of different theories to have against public policy. This last one, down here, statute of limitations and latches, and I think that's our slide coming up in a second. Give me a second here. Oh, no, I'll just give it to you because it's not the next slide. They think it's going to be in next week's lecture. But statute of limitations is a legal theory that says you can only bring a claim within so many years of when the incident happened. So construction contracts, a written contract, and this is state of Illinois, some states are different. State of Illinois, a written contract is valid for 10 years. 10 years for a written contract, any written contract in Illinois. An oral contract is valid for only 5 years. So let's say we have an oral contract for you to build me a house, and it needs to be a proper house and leak-free and all this other stuff. Well, on year 6, or maybe it's the first day of year 6, the house starts leaking. And we had an oral contract. And I sue you. Your house is defective. You did bad construction, blah, blah, blah. You're going to make an argument that this contract is no longer enforceable because we had an oral agreement. It's past 5 years. And the law says I don't have to be held responsible forever. The law said if it's oral, it's fair. You're only responsible for 5 years. Or if it's written, only for 10 years. So that is a valid contract, meeting of the minds, understood parties. But it's late. It's outside of the statute of limitations. Okay? Any questions on that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the voidable contract, the example that you gave for the zoning and flooding.
Yeah.
If it's not, if the information that is withheld is like public knowledge or maybe you should research it, is it still voidable because they do that?
It's a great concept. Great question. So, like the best one, the best way to look at that one is the example of the zoning. So, there's going to be some obligation implied by custom and practice that the contractor is going to figure out what the zoning is for that property. So, while they may say, "Hey, you withheld, you didn't tell me that this is zoned for industrial," they should have known. And so, you can, as the owner, when you want to stop the contract and not have to pay or whatever the situation that comes up that causes the lawsuit, you can, make that defense. And part of that in proving your case is you have to prove that industry custom and practice shows that this should have happened. And you also kind of have to show on your side, for that example only, you're like, and trust me, this isn't trying to take disparagement over owners. You can be like, I didn't know. I don't build houses for a living. I hired you to do all that. And in fact, that happens a lot of times in residential. I do a lot of residential contracts for very, very high end, in the millions and tens of millions of dollars. And these owners don't know. I mean, most owners don't know. They don't know what's going on. And so you'll have to show that, because they'll sit back and say, you withheld that information from me. You're like, no, I didn't withhold anything. I just figured you would figure that out. Why didn't you tell me about this? So in that instance, you're right. There would be a defense by the owner, and the contractor may have his liability because it was, or her liability, because they expected or should have been expected to know that it's not properly zoned. With the water coming down in the leaky basement, in this situation, the contractor knew this stuff because this wasn't the first house that was sold in the subdivision, and they knew that they had problems with the water retention system. The owner didn't know anything about it, so they wouldn't know. So when they were, that's why we were able to rescind the contract, because the contractor was going to be, he was going to lose anyway. So he looked at it as what's my net loss here? I can get the house back and fix the streets because I'm going to have to fix the streets anyway. Or I can spend a lot of money in this lawsuit and then have to give the house back and fix the street. So he decided, let's get the house back without spending the legal fees. So, but yes, that can come in. Custom and practice can come in. So, anything else? Or not even custom and practice, just common knowledge. Okay. Elements of valid contract. Now, this is going to sound a lot like the claims that we talked about last week, about how to make a claim. But we're going to do it just for contract specifically, because it's a little different, the elements for a tort, which will come up in a couple more weeks. So the four things you need to have is you need to have an offer And acceptance, proper acceptance, okay, we'll talk about what that means. Mutual consideration, that's that. I give you, you give that. What is consideration? And then absence of a valid defense to enforce. It's not void, it's not voidable, it's not unenforceable under the law. It's just a valid contract. So you can't have that. You can't, if there's no, there's no valid defense that exists. Okay? So those are your four main points. Walk through them. Offer and acceptance. Now, offer and acceptance is important with respect to timing. And you guys, well, this will be something on the test as far as a little bit of timing and what comes, who's on first, who's on second, what happens in what order. So I make an offer to you. I will pay you $10,000 if you design me a house. You will be able to accept the offer or reject the offer. If you reject the offer and say, no, I'm sorry, my fees are going to be $15,000, not $10,000. That's not enough. That is a rejection of the offer. And if you say it's $15,000, that is actually a counteroffer. You are now the offeror, and they are the ones that need to get to make the acceptance or not. The action of either rejecting, no, if you just said, no, I can't do it for $10,000, you have rejected the contract, you've rejected the offer, there can never be a contract based on that term. If you say, oh, I'd like to do this house for you, but I have to charge you $15,000, that is also a rejection of the original. They both terminate that original offer. The $10,000, no matter what, is off the table. It's either no, or I'd love to, but I have to charge you $15,000. $10,000 is never in existence. It's like it never happened. And it's your side that's making the offer. Okay? Second thing that's important for timing. Your offer terminates after a reasonable period of time. Maybe it's something the opposite. Somebody comes to you, you're the architect, and they say, hey, I really want to build this house here. Let's talk about, you know, what I want. I want a three-bedroom house with 3.5 baths. I want this, I want that. You kind of go through and you do the basics of what it is. And you say to them, you know, I think I can do that. And I say back to you, well, what's that going to cost? What do you think that's going to cost? Well, I'm going to do, let me, this is just the back of a napkin, but I think you could probably design it for $50,000 for what you want. That's $50,000. Okay. I got to go back. I got to talk with my wife, or I got to figure this out. I'll get back to you. If I call you back, then maybe I have to talk to 3 or 4 other architects. But if I call you back in a week, or even a month, say, hey, I want to do that $50,000. That's pretty reasonable. You know, you have some time. If I call you in 6 months, maybe even after the turn of the year, because a lot of times rates go up on January 1st for people's business, and I say, hey, I want to hire you for that, and I start working, and you guys start working on the house for me, is it reasonable that that $50,000 still is the offer? Or could it have gone up? So timing and what's reasonable, that's why I have it in quotes there, may have to look at the circumstances. Maybe there was something communicated earlier on of why there was a delay. Maybe it's understood in the industry it takes a little bit of time. So reasonable never is, it's not one defined term. That discussion and where you said, yeah, back to the napkin, maybe $50,000, maybe it's even not reasonable, is that really an offer? But the timing and how long before that offer terminates or expires is actually a better way to look at it. I say terminate, but we think about it expiring. What's considered reasonable? And that's where we come back to my two favorite words, it depends. But there are some things, I think my example, if you come back within a week or a month, reasonable. 6 months, maybe not. So, third, the offer terminates as a matter of law upon death or insanity of the parties or destruction of the subject matter, fire, theft, etc. So, clearly, like if we're going to do a deal and I actually had a good friend of mine, this happened 4 or 5 months ago, he called me up and he had a partnership with a gentleman that had a partnership in owning this property. That gentleman had a partnership, had the deal with his dad for years, my friend's dad. And then after my friend's dad died, it was just assumed that my friend would then be the partner with this guy. Well, there had been some discussions between my friend's dad and the other partner about some terms of part of the deal that had never been finalized. And then he died. And so when things came up later about issues with the property, I had to get a lot of facts kind of sorted through. How it turned out that these terms never were formalized, were finalized, I guess. And I explained to my friend, I said, well, any obligations your father owed terminated upon his death. So you can't fulfill something if you're not around. Even though my friend had assumed certain rights of the deal and the agreement, he didn't assume everything because some things hadn't been finalized. Sanity, if somebody has an issue, I mean, that's going to be rarely come up. The destruction of the subject matter, this can happen, like, let's say, I'm trying to think of an example. Let's say I'm selling a car. And I want to sell the car to Tommy across the street. Now I got his driver's license, I got an old beater, I want to sell it to him so he can drive to school. And I have a conversation with his dad, because I can't get into this conversation with Tommy, because he's a minor. And I say to his dad, I'm like, John, we'll sell you the car for like $4,000. You know, it still runs fine, but you know, it probably needs some tires and everything else, but I'll sell it to you for $4,000. I said, great. And then I get in an accident with it. Because it dinged up. And I'm like, okay, I'm delivering the car, I want $4,000. He's like, no, I'm not going to pay you $4,000 for this car. Well, we had a deal. It's in writing. Look, here's the car, here's the keys, where's my $4,000? Well, there's been destruction of the property. It's a change in the term, and it cannot be enforced because it's not what the deal was. So the offer to sell that car for $4,000 is gone. It's been terminated, no matter what. Okay? All right. Now, this is another thing you want to think about. This will be on the exam as well, just kind of what the timing is. The party making the offer may revoke that offer, and the revocation is effective upon communication to the other party. Hey, remember that? I got a phone call. Hey, remember that meeting we had? I said I could probably design that house for $50,000. Yeah, that's great. I'm still thinking about it, I'll let you know. Well, it's going to be $60,000 now. Upon me receiving that phone call, that $50,000 has been revoked once the communication happens. But it has to be upon me receiving the communication, okay? Effective on communicating to the other party. Tiny problems with that. Offers and their revocation are effective when received. Let's say instead of me making a phone call, and I know this doesn't happen in this day and age, but for my example here, I write you a letter. I know it would be an email or a text and say, hey, my rights have gone up. But I write you a letter and I say, hey, we had that conversation straight. I went back and looked at it. I checked my back of the napkin. It's going to be $60,000 instead of $50,000. And I put in the mail. This is the mailbox rule, which is down at the bottom here. And it's in the mail, but you haven't gotten it. And you call me up before you get the mail. And you say, it's the next day. I mailed it on Wednesday. You call me on Thursday and say, hey, I did all my due diligence. I want to hire you. Start designing the house. We don't talk about the dollars. We just say, start designing the house. And then I get the envelope. We get the mail on Friday. So Wednesday was when you mailed it. Thursday is when I had the call with you. Friday I get the mail that says it's going to be $60,000. I just read it and I'm like, whatever. And then you bill me $60,000, and I'm like, no, our deal was $50,000. No, I sent you a letter. Well, it's not revoked. That $50,000 isn't revoked until I receive it. I receive it on Friday. We had a deal on Thursday. Our deal before that didn't even count because I had tried to revoke it, so I had tried to get rid of that $50,000 to $60,000. So the deal that was met on Thursday is the deal. So, they're received by the second party. Acceptance is effective when it's made. So in that same discussion, it's made. I never accepted the $50,000 any time beforehand. I accepted on Thursday. That's when acceptance happens. It's when it's made. Even if the notice of acceptance has not been received by the party making the offer. Let's say on Thursday, instead of me calling you, I send you a letter. Wednesday, you tell me in a letter, not $50,000, it's $60,000. Thursday, I write you a letter and say, I'm hiring you, and that's all I say. Friday, I get the letter. You get the letter, I'm hiring you. On Saturday, I'm hiring you. You have no idea that I'm hiring you for $50,000. You think I'm hiring you for $60,000 because you already mailed it. But it's when you mailed it, not when he received it. Because you are accepting the offer at that time. So it's a little bit, it seems unfair. Because the person making the offer has to wait until the other side gets it, but the person receiving doesn't have to wait until you get it. Like there could be, and this again, doesn't happen as much anymore because communication is so much more instantaneous, but it still does happen. There are still contracts that are signed and written. Sometimes it just takes forever for people to sign contracts. Just, I've had many cases, like I have a project right now where we're building a townhome out in New York City. It's a $10 million townhome. They still haven't signed the contract. They've been constructing it for over a year. So, like, what are the terms? And we keep pushing and pushing and pushing. We're the owner. We're like, we got to get this signed, but they haven't signed it yet. So, like, is there going to be, and there's been changes in the prices. And the parties know each other very well. We've been very close and contacted it. So, but that happens. So, sometimes you do have this, what is the offer of acceptance and the timing of that? And the concept of this mailbox rule, you have to have it, is so you don't have multiple acceptances. We have to have something in writing, some law, some custom and practice, some understanding of when contracts are going to be enforced in timing-wise. So the mailbox rule makes sense. There will be a mailbox rule question on the test. So. Okay. So we have offer and acceptance. Those are the first two parts you have to have. And proper acceptance, remember I said the proper, and I don't know if I highlighted this as much. Proper acceptance, you have to accept and mirror what the offer is. So I keep thinking the examples of 50 and 60. They aren't mirror. The acceptance is, the offer is, I will design you a 3-bedroom, 3.5-bath house with all the bells and whistles that we talked about. For $50,000, the acceptance is, I accept you designing a 3-bedroom, 3.5-bath house with bells and whistles for $50,000. They have to mirror. So that's a proper acceptance. It can't be, for $50,000, it's a 3-bedroom, 4-bathroom house. I've changed the term. Now that's a counter offer. So the proper acceptance concept is mirrored. All right. So the next thing, so we have offer, proper acceptance, and then consideration. What's consideration? Consideration is giving or agreeing to give something of value. So in the architectural world, your time is value. You're going to be billing by the hour or billing by the project or however the billing structure is set up, but it's your time. You are providing services. There's going to be some products you're going to provide. You're going to provide a product of drawings, specifications, maybe some models, maybe some renderings, maybe some axons, whatever you guys put together to help the builders as well as the owner. Sometimes if you're going to be doing a project for a public entity or even a private entity, they're going to build this cool model for people to come and see. Maybe it's to help in the course of the project to get revenue from shareholders, to get donations, or whatever it might be that you build that model. So there's going to be some products, but generally as an architect, it's your services, and that has value. Obviously, I'm going to pay you for that, or hopefully I'm going to pay you for that. Clearly, obviously, that's a value. So that's agreeing to give something of value. That's consideration, and both sides do that. Now, another way is performing or offering to do something of a detriment to me. I'm going to sell you my land. The detriment is I no longer own that land. Now, that's really kind of like, well, of course you don't own it, you're selling it. But that, by the law, considers that to be a detriment. Or even this concept of your time. You know, you guys could be out doing something else, working on another project. So your detriment is the giving away of time. And so sometimes you're going to look at those types of things, and maybe it's not going to be this traditional, but the detriment, and we won't have to get into, there's other areas of business and otherwise where detriment comes into play. Maybe an example would be, let me think about this. Oh, here's one. So you guys probably have heard of, like, non-compete clauses. Sometimes what will happen is, I work for a company, I'm going to come in, I have science and knowledge background, and I'm working for this high-tech company, and I get paid a really good salary, and it's something very valuable, the things that I do. And if the contract says, my employment agreement, which is just a contract, it says, if I leave your company, I am not allowed to work for your competitors. Sometimes those competitors are listed. Maybe somebody understood who their competitors are. I'm not allowed to work for any of your competitors for 1 year after I leave your company. So it's a non-compete clause. They don't want me to take all the stuff that I can bring and all the secrets you guys have and just give it to somebody else. Those are valid legal contracts, and the consideration I'm giving to you is it could be to my detriment, because if I went to the competitor, they may pay me a whole lot more money. I'm giving up that opportunity for at least 1 year to work for you, so that's to my detriment. So that's another way where it's not like selling my land, but I'm giving up potential opportunities in the future. That consideration, that's enough of what you are providing, something of value. So we have payment of the money, performing a service, giving up ownership, that would be the land, or agreeing to forego that has the possibility of being valuable. That would be me not being able to work for the competitor. Any questions on that? Okay. Consideration is in every contract. Even in the unilateral contract. But in the unilateral contract, only one party has to give the consideration. That's, I will pay you $1 million if you write in and you win on the McDonald's lottery. Or the McDonald's Monopoly game thing. So that's when I'm giving up consideration. The other side doesn't have to if they don't need to. Okay. Some other things that comes up in consideration. Illusory promises. That's not consideration. What's an illusory promise? When only one side is required to perform, that's one way. It's unenforceable, may include deception, or maybe you say to everything, I will sell you an item for a specific price, but I'm selling you everything I want to for this price. Well, there's no promise there because I'm only selling you what I want to sell. I'll sell you everything that I want to sell for $10,000. You're like, oh my God, I'm going to get all this stuff. Well, maybe nothing because I don't have to sell it. That's an illusory promise. There is no consideration. One side's required to perform. Now, that can be a little different here. In the unilateral contract, you're allowed to have that because that's the promise, but it's written in there. No participation necessary. Void where prohibited. That's a state where you don't allow it. So that's written out there specifically. So it's not illusory because it specifically says no participation necessary. It's known for that. But if there's a... I'm trying to think of an example where only one side's required to perform, where it would be an illusory contract. I will think of something as we kind of continue on here. But the concept here is that consideration has to be mutual. Both sides have to do it. And if there's only one side that's doing something, the other isn't doing it, that's not a consideration, not proper. Then they can't necessarily say that there was a contract. It becomes voidable. So, consideration may go to a third party. So remember, I was talking about the strip mall project here. Well, ultimately, one of the questions that came down to that was, is we were providing services in the construction of that strip mall, and the third party was the original owner's daughter. And so she was able to argue that we owed her duties because of the assignment of the contract and the way the deal was between her and her father, that we owed them obligations. Or sometimes you may say, and this has happened with me, I'm hiring you to install a new kitchen range and microwave. This exact thing happened to me for my mom. I'm paying you. I'm hiring you. Here's her phone number. I'm at apps. We do all that stuff. And I have nothing. I'm never going to receive it. I'm not going to receive the range. I'm not going to receive the work. It's all for my mom. She's not paying you a dime. So the consideration is you are providing, or app is providing, the materials and the service to install. I'm paying for you, but it's going to a third party. So the consideration can work that way too. That makes sense? Okay. Substitution for consideration is detrimental reliance. So I relied on you to my detriment. I was going to go out, and I'm out there, and I'm shopping for houses. Well, let's bring it back into construction. I'll give the house one in a second. You come to me and you say, hey, I want you to build my house. Or I want you to design. Let's make it for the architect. I want you to design the house. Okay, we talk about it, and I say, you know, I got to look at my schedule. I got a small staff here. I really love your work. I think it's great. It's just what I need to do. And I talked to the people that have seen your work. I just love your design work. We'll figure this out. We come to this concept, and we get to its terms. We know how much it's going to be, and you're like, you know, this is really going to stretch it for him. I'm not really sure if I can do this. I just want you to know that. And it's made known that you as the architect are relying, and you even say so much as saying, look, are we really going to do this deal? Because I have three other people that are waiting in line, but this is what I want to do. I want to do this house for you, but I'm going to have to give up some other projects. No, we're all good. We're fine. And then I call you up 3 weeks later, and I'm like, I found somebody else. You have detrimentally relied upon me. You have lost other jobs. We never signed that contract. You sent me the contract. I was reviewing it. You restaffed things. You turned down 2 other jobs. And then I told you no. You can't enforce that contract. I could say to you, wait, you didn't give me any consideration. You didn't design anything. You did nothing for me. I don't have to pay you a dime because you didn't give me anything. You sent me a contract, but I never signed it. How can I be forced to pay you this contract? You're going to say, I detrimentally relied upon you. My consideration was I expected to do this job. We communicated about this, and I turned down other projects because of that. Now, the question comes in is, what's the value of the damages for that? But the reality is you have given consideration. And if the terms were agreed upon about what was going to be designed, because you wrote it in the contract and you sent it to them, even though it wasn't signed, you're going to be able to make some type of argument that based on your belief and their promise, because he said, don't worry about it. I said, don't worry about it. We will do this deal. And then I pulled back from it. That promise is enough to say you detrimentally relied upon me. Question?
How does this one work or relate with the timing and the amount of time that it takes to get that?
So this one, if it's a couple, 3 weeks, I don't think that's anything unreasonable if you look at the business in a transaction where it's, you know, $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 are going to be done. So you saying, we can still enforce that. Your argument's going to be made is that when you sent the contract to me with the terms, so we had this meeting, we had all this discussion and everything else, and you're like, look, you promised me we're going to be doing this deal because I'm going to have to turn some of those down. Yeah, we're good. You send me the contract with all the terms. The argument is the offer has been presented to me, and it's been based on the detrimental reliance from the day before when we were talking, where you said, yes, we have a deal. Maybe all the details are in that written contract, but probably you guys discussed the three-bedroom, three-and-a-half-bath house, so I would know how much my staff needs to be. You probably discussed some of the pricing. So maybe not all of the nitty-gritty, but the major chunks were probably discussed, because you would have to do that to figure out, God, I'm going to have to turn down these other jobs if I have to do this big a job. And that discussion happened. So you can make the argument that in that meeting, not even when you sent the letter with the contract, in that meeting there was an agreement because you had already said, I have to turn down projects. And so the contract comes, and that's just saying, I am now confirming in writing what we agreed upon. And 2, 3, 4 weeks later, when I come back and say, I found somebody else, it's not them rejecting your offer, because you're going to argue it was already accepted. And that you gave consideration because you turned down other projects of which I knew about. So you're going to say everything happened already. There's really no timing issue there. That's not a timing question. It's more about consideration. Does that help? I think what you're... Maybe let me ask you a question. Is your concern that when I come back and say, no, I'm going a different direction, is your concern that it's still a reasonable period of time for me to reject your offer? Is that what you're saying? Great question. The reason why it's not reasonable is because you believe that when I said to you, if I take this job, I have to turn on other things, and we had come to the terms, and you said, I will do this for you, but you got to promise me that I'm not that we're going to do this work. As soon as you said yes to that promise, when I come back later and say no, you are breaching that promise. That contract has been made. So your later saying, no, I don't want to do you, is not a rejecting of the offer, because you already accepted the offer. You accepted it orally. I confirmed it in writing afterwards, but the oral contract of that discussion, including saying, it's going to be tough for me, but we're going to do this deal, and you said, yes, we will, or I said, yes, we will, that's the promise. So the later rejection is not the later communication is not a rejection of the offer. It's a breach of contract.
But I promise is not an offer statement,
it's
basically a
oral contract. Correct. Yes. Yeah. Yep. Does that help?
Because that goes back to the point where it's like the acceptance is a factor of promise.
Exactly. And so the promise is I've accepted, and that happened during that conversation. And the later of saying I'm not going to do this deal with you is not a rejection, it's a breach. Because you had a duty. I promised you my duty is to live up to my promise. And the promise is now distilled into writing, which we had talked about anyway, but now we distilled it into writing, but I still made that promise. And you were relying on that when you wrote the contract. Question?
So, to some of the contracts we talked about can be oral.
Yes. Any contract can be oral.
Can be oral. But people lie.
Correct. That's why you don't want them oral.
Yes.
Okay. So you got that right on the nose. The reason why you don't want oral contracts is because people lie. But if you have the piece of paper with their signature on it, then you can say this is what it was. Now, sometimes it comes into what's the meaning of the contract and this and that. But yeah, the written word is what you want. And that's, as your lawyer, I'm going to always tell you to write it down, even if it's on a napkin. Swear to God. Like, there are litigation on people that have just sketched things out. And I'm going to, by the way, at the end of the semester, I'm going to give you guys a written contract and a letter on how you respond to a client. Say, you know, like, pursuant to our meeting today, we had all this other great stuff, and here's what I think the understanding is, and here's my contract. And you send it just to confirm things in writing. But it could be even so simple as saying, after that meeting, you just send an email. Hey, it was a great meeting with you. Which is good business practice anyway. I mean, a lot of this stuff is logic, but you should do this. This is a good business practice. It's a great meeting with you today. I'm really excited, looking forward to the project. You don't have to put in that email, oh, by the way, I'm going to lose other projects if I don't have that, because you've already had that discussion. But you would say, and I'm looking forward into, just as a bullet point, we're going to do a three-bedroom, three-bedroom house, blah, 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 blah. It's a short little email. That's enough. And you say, I'm confirming our agreement. So it's not the written contract, it's confirming that you already had an oral agreement, which included that promise that you're not going to step away because I have to potentially lose business. Okay? All right, so that's consideration. Now, remember the last point is it's defenses. You can't have a valid defense to the enforcement of the contract. So what are the types of defenses we have here? Mutual mistake of fact. I thought it was going to be for industrial. It turns out to be residential. I thought I was doing a two-bedroom house. It's a three-bedroom house. There's a mutual mistake of fact. What are the terms of the agreement? That's why you want it in writing, because if it's an oral, oh, God, I remember telling you that. Well, maybe you did, or maybe you remember telling the other architect you interviewed with. So the oral is to eliminate or help to eliminate the fact mistakes. And it can be a mutual mistake of fact. It can be a unilateral mistake as well. Now, it's much more common, well, let's say it's much less common, the best way to say it. It's less common to be able to break a contract on a unilateral mistake. Taking your question about the zoning. I didn't tell you, contractor, that this was a industrial and it's residential. And you can be like, well, I didn't know. I'm the one that had the mistake. I knew it was industrial. I knew it wasn't residential, but I didn't know what that meant. I'm an unsophisticated owner. But you as the contractor can say, well, I had a unilateral mistake. Well, was that really valid? Is that something that makes sense? There should be, for that, a mutual mistake. But in the reformation of the rescission one, in the unilateral mistake, that's one of the other arguments. Remember, I said when you go to law school, you have different theories. We use the rescission theory for the party that my client that bought the house in the subdivision that it flooded. Their mistake was they thought they were getting a house that didn't leak. I didn't know that there could be these problems. Now, if they had been informed that, and sometimes you guys may or may not know this, like if you sell a house in Illinois, and most states have this, and it has had leaks in the past over a certain period of time, you have to disclose that. And so people do buy houses that have defects. You know, you get the inspector to come on, you need to have the radon fixed, or you need, like, there's lots of things that happen that people do buy houses that aren't perfect, and they know that. But if they don't, it could be a unilateral mistake. And in the instance with the party that my client that had the subdivision, the house at the bottom of the hill in the subdivision, it was so much so that we rescinded the entire contract, that it didn't exist in the past. So that's another defense. Fraud. If you lie to me, well, that's clearly not a meeting of the minds, because you lied to me. You defrauded me. So I don't have to fulfill my terms of the contract if you defrauded me. If it's illegal, you know, if you want me to hurt someone, or if you want me to build something that's illegal, whatever it might be, that it's not valid to code or law or whatever, that's a defense to performing the contract. Lack of capacity, that would be someone who doesn't have the mental capacity or someone that's a minor. That's where that normally comes in. Duress or coercion. I gave you that example. We already have an operating agreement, a contract, where most of your business and your company's lifeblood comes from our deal that's already going on. I want a side deal now with something else at a cheaper price. I threaten to get rid of one or reduce one, which will affect your business if you don't give me the side deal. That's duress or coercion. Now, one thing about this one here that's important to remember is the courts will always believe that a written contract between parties is not under duress or coercion, and the parties are on equal footing. So it's not always the David and Goliath situation. You could have the big giant company that can manage and manipulate its business prices, and maybe you have big company General Motors contracting with big company Bechtel, where they're going to have the highest prices back and forth because they're both big companies. But maybe General Motors contracts with a smaller IT company down here, not a Bechtel, or a smaller, sorry, Bechtel is a construction company, smaller construction company down here. General Motors may be able to pay that smaller construction company less fees and less worse pricing than they pay up here, because there is a unequal bargaining power. I really want to work and build these factories for General Motors, so I'll take a cheaper price. The courts don't look at that as coercion or duress. Just because it's big and little doesn't mean that it's coercion or duress. And just because one company takes advantage of I'm contracting with a smaller so I can set my rates lower doesn't mean it's coercion or duress. It has to have another component, an intent to try to manipulate. That's your coercion or duress. So, like I said, David and Goliath are equal footing in big and little. But if Goliath manipulates something, maybe not defraud, but manipulate something with an intent to use that power over them, that could be coercion or duress. Question?
So I'm thinking about this other lawsuits, it seems like when you operated in bad faith.
Yes.
That, what category would that fall into when it comes to
So, operating in bad faith means it could be a number of different things. It could be that the performance of your services, and I'll try to give an example, because it's a very gray zone. It's harder to prove that. So, let's say you're a general contractor that has a pretty decent reputation in the industry, and I want to hire you to build my high-end residential home. So, I hire you and I go out to you, and I go to two or three other contractors, and one contractor says it's going to be $10 million, the other contractor says we're going to build it for $9.5 million, and you come and say, I can do it for $7.5 million. I'm like, oh my God, that's like $2.5 million less than the highest one, or $2 million from the other one? And that's a lot of money. And then we have discussions. Don't worry, I use the best people and everything else, and the reason why I'm able to do this is because I know this and I know that and everything else. And then it turns out the reason why you came in with $7.5 million is because you hired really schlocky subcontractors. That's an argument that there's bad faith there, because I hired you on this reputation of high-end. You promised by your marketing materials that you're one of the best in the industries. You only work for quality contractors and all this boogie, all this stuff that's in your marketing. Doesn't make it in the contract. And it's not to say that the subcontractors aren't performing to industry standard. The electrician still does electrical work. The carpenter still does carpentry work. But it's not at the carpentry work of a $10 million house. It's the carpentry work of a $400,000 or $300,000 or $200,000 house. And so if you are going to purchase something, you have an expectation that's not written in there. And I have the expectation based on our meetings and human nature. And it's not going to be in the contract. And then it turns out you bring in these crappy workers for what I expected. That's bad faith. Does that make sense? So it doesn't fall in any of this. What happens is this, it's not defense of the contract, but it may be defense of having to pay you all the what I'm going to pay you. I'm not going to pay you $10 million, I'm going to pay you less. Or if it turns out that my house leaks because you hired bad carpenters and bad roofers, or less sophisticated, there's a specialized roof for the house because that's what the architect, who's a high-end architect, and because it's a $10 million house, that specialized roof, that roofer didn't know how to install it because they'd never done that, and now it leaks. Well, I as the owner have to pay for the fixing of that leak. I can come to you and say, I expected you to do that. You were bad faith in saying I can handle it all. I get the money that I have to spend to fix my roof. Okay? Any other questions on that? Statute of limitations. I did talk about that. I gave you a little preview, but I'll go over it again here, so it's on your slide. 10 years for written contract, 5 years for oral or implied contracts. Remember that it was implied in fact and implied in law, those quasi-contracts. So if your vet, if you have to sue your vet, you have to sue them within 5 years, not within 10 years, because it's implied. Now, in Illinois, and different states have different statutes. So remember, if we talk about the hierarchy, there's that statute, and then there's, and the statute is a codified law. So while in Illinois there's the law, it's written down in the statutes, it says written contract 10 years, oral contract 5 years. That's in the law in Illinois for bringing a claim for breach of contract. But they have a sub-law here that's only for construction. It's section 13-214. And what it says, and this is a little bit, it's not clear, crystal clear from when you first read it, but I'll explain it as best I can. Instead of 5 or 10, it's 4 years from the discovery of the problem. We have a written contract. It's signed in 2020. Arguably, I could make a lawsuit up to and file a lawsuit against you, right? Written contract by 2030. That's 10 years, right? No, not necessarily. In 2022, I find out that my roof is leaking. Bad construction. I don't have till 2030 to sue you. I have until 2026. 4 years from the time of discovery. You're like, well, that doesn't seem fair because, like every other person that gets a contract, is allowed to wait up to 10 years, a written contract. That doesn't seem fair. Why do I only get 4 years? Well, here's where the second part comes in. 10 years from the date of act or omission and the discovery, you can actually add these together in Illinois. Let's say you're living in that house and it doesn't start leaking until year 9, day 363 or 364. And you discover on that, right before the 10 years. Do you have to file a lawsuit the next day? No. You can file a lawsuit 4 years later. So that lawsuit could come in year 13 and 364 days. You have 4 years from the discovery, and Illinois gives you 10 years to discover. So it is fair. But the clock starts ticking once you discover it. So the 10 years of written contracts stand within that 10 years that you say of when to discover. And then it can add 4 more years on top of that. Other states, Wisconsin and Minnesota, 6 years no matter what. Nothing other. It doesn't change whether you discover or not. 6 years cut and dry. There's none of this other interim period. But in Illinois, it can go up to 14 years. There's 4 states or 3 states that are like that. Question? Yeah, let me. So the question is do you have a 10-year protection plan and then you have 4 years to kind of write what you discovered and bring a claim for that? So think of it a little bit differently because the concept of protection plan brings into this concept of warranty. Warranty is another theory I don't think I have it on here, but we'll talk about warranty throughout the semester as well, but I'll give you the precursor to it. And it has to do with who's responsible for the proofs of the claim. So let's say what's very common is a one-year warranty. You always hear that. I got a one-year warranty. Maybe in tires you get a three-year warranty, but in the house construction, roofs, there are certain things that are specialized. Roofs get a longer warranty, but most of the construction, for purposes of discussion, is 1 year. If you discover something's wrong within that 1 year of when you get the house, when you move in or when the contract's signed, and there'll be some nuances whether it's move-in date or contract signed date. You always want it to be at the owner of the move-in date, so you have that full 1 year warranty. If you discover the defect within that 1 year, you don't have to prove anything. You just call up the contractor and say, my house is leaking, it's 1 year warranty, you fix it. And it's up to them to say the defect is because you damaged it, not because I built it wrong. The burden of proof that the fault or the defect is not theirs is on them. That's the 1 year warranty, so that's that protection plan. The 10 years, once you get past that 1 year warranty, and think of that, is if let's say you call me up and say it's in the year, and I say, I didn't do this. This is not my problem. You guys ruined my roof. You can sue me for breach of warranty. That's one type of lawsuit. You could also sue me for breach of contract. Even though the warranty might be in the contract, the breach of contract was I didn't perform my construction correctly. That's the 10 years for the breach of contract of the construction. For that proof, you have to prove to me that it was my fault. Breach of warranty, you don't have to prove anything. I have to prove it's your fault. That only goes for the 1 year, maybe for a roof, 5 or 10 years. Breach of construction, you prove that I made it wrong, I did it wrong, and I can defend it. But you have two claims potentially, but the two claims only last, that proof of purchase type, that protection plan, is the warranty phase. But the construction, defective construction, could be up to 10 years or any time during that period when you discover. Okay? Question?
So that, in that case with the warranty, does that have to be expressly stated within the written contract, or is that an industry standard of having a one-year warranty?
Great question. So the question is do you have to have an express warranty in a contract? Yes and no. So there is, in most states, in Illinois, there's what's called the implied warranty of habitability. And so concept is implied. It's even said there. It's called the implied warranty of habitability. The implied warranty of habitability falls back on what you're expected. I'm expected to get a house that doesn't leak, that the windows work, that the lights go on. That's what everybody expects in a house, or in a factory, or in whatever is being built. There's some things that we all expected, but in residential, it's that implied warranty of habitability. So it needs to be. And mostly it applies in residential, that implied warranty of habitability, because it is going to be an unbalanced homeowner and contractor, as opposed to business and contractor different. So that's an implied warranty. Now, there are written warranties that are going to be more. Like, you're going to have a written warranty that say this is because the contractor wants to keep that written that implied warranty limited to a year. So the contractor's going to want to put in, said, we only have a warranty for 1 year, so the implied warranty doesn't go forever, or for at least 10 years. The contractor may want to put in, well, for your furnace and for your roof and some other pieces of equipment, I'm not creating those, I'm not manufacturing, so you're going to get what the manufacturer's warranty says. So I'm going to hand you those pieces of paper, kind of like if you went and bought the dishwasher at App, only he bought the dishwasher for you, they're going to give you the warranty that App's going to give you. They're going to be transferable. Those are going to be in writing too, and they'll be specific to different elements of the house. So, does that help?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, question.
Is the 10 years transferable if, like, the property is sold to another person?
Great question, and the answer is no. Because the contract creates that construction and the terms that come out of that. So when you transfer to somebody else, that person never has a contract with the original contractor. So even though you're suing, this concept here is only about timing, not about a contract. So if you and I are in contract, you can always sue me and I can always sue you. But if you sell the house to you over the year, we don't have a contract, so it doesn't matter about the timing because you can't sue me because I don't have a contract, and there's no tort. You can't sue me in tort because I didn't build the wall properly. Now, if the wall fell on a guest that was visiting your house, they could sue me in tort because there's an injury, but not a contract claim. So that's where things get a little bit less clear.
And then would it be like
they give kind of one thing that you were talking about, though, between the seller and the buyer. That would happen for the habitability.
So, it's a little different. The warranty of habitability, again, falls within the relationship between the purchaser and the contractor, as opposed to the secondary purchaser. It can transfer, but for the same reason why a contractor wants to say, my warranty is only good for 1 year, many contracts will say, and the warranty of habitability is non-transferable. Now, you can always negotiate that out, so there can be a transfer of that. You may assign those contracts, but those things, so there are certain things that are non-transferable. But what will often be transferable is the roof warranty or the equipment warranty. A lot of those, you just give it to your neighbor, the person that's buying the house, and say, here's this, and then there can be an enforcement of that. So it just kind of depends on what's writing in there, but there can be certain transfers. The best contracts for the contractor side are going to limit the ability for transferring. I need to agree to a transfer, or this is non-transferable no matter what, or what have you. So that's when, and remember we talk about, I keep saying, contracts can't have everything. That's when that back end of a napkin is good for the basis, but doesn't have all the details. That's why you send that detailed contract later that has all these other smaller bits and pieces in it. So, and even when we talked about last week, we talked about at the end of a mediation, if there's a settlement, that mediator is going to create an agreement, a memorandum of understanding. But the full details of the final agreement is probably going to be worked out later with the lawyers to cover all these little gaps. You try to fill the gaps.
Could that be the benefit? Like, I know there are some developers who have, like, a separate construction company.
Yes.
They can sell it to themselves and eliminate the opportunity to then
Well, they do that because they want to protect the different entities. Yes, that's something that you do, and you have to get careful. You have to be careful about how the movement of the materials or the contracts and the obligations are that's happening. You could come into where it's being done intentionally to avoid obligations and duties that could be illegal, and then there's piercing the corporate veil, and that gets very detailed. But yes, what happens very often is a developer for Development A is going to be called Development A LLC, and Development B is going to be Development B LLC. I mean, literally, some of these names of these LLCs are like so basic. You know, it's very common to have whatever the address of the unit is going to be. You know, 401 Michigan LLC, and that's what they're building. And it's a giant, you know, it's Gilbane Construction Company, but every single project has its own LLC. So, okay, let me see how much we got left here. Just a few more. Okay, and we were just talking, this is actually great, your question goes right into assignment. So contracts, how do you transfer? Sometimes, like here's an example where you have a company, I'm building a factory, and during the course of that project, bigger company comes in and buys me. Well, who's going to be able to take over those obligations? I mean, little company's gone now, so who's going to pay the contractor? Of course, the contractor wants the bigger company to take over, so there may be an assignment of the rights of the contract. So the assignment of a contract is giving contractual right or duty to another party and being disconnected from the transaction. Little company has a contractor with a contract. Little company has a contract with a contractor. Sorry about that. Little company gets bought by big company. Little company assigns the construction contract to big company. Big company now has all the responsibilities, and little company is removed. I'm assigning my rights. Now, there can be partial assignments, but for purposes, when I assign it, assigning it to someone else, I am out of the game. I have no more obligations. You will often see in the contract, in the construction contract and other contracts as well, you cannot assign this unless approved by the other side. The other side may say, maybe it's little company being bought by little company. Well, maybe the other side doesn't trust the second little company. The second little company maybe is a little bit shakier. Maybe they don't know if they're going to get paid, and they're not quite as clear on that. If first little company can't assign it to second little company without the approval of the contractor, first little company may stay on the hook. And so there may be a delegation of obligations as opposed to an assignment. So both parties can stay on the hook. But most of the time, depending on how you write it, you're going to want to have the ability to assign without approval, or you could have approval that's not unreasonably withheld. If I can prove that small other little company has good financials and good records, and that's why they're buying us, your rejection or your objection to that contractor, to this deal, isn't reasonable because I've given you enough information and evidence that you're still going to get paid. So there's some balances you have, but the point of assignment is giving the right of duty to another party and being disconnected. Delegation is the same as assignment except for the giver stays involved. In the delegation of obligations, maybe we get into this battle back and forth with the contractor and he says, I don't feel comfortable. Then you say, well, I'm going to stay on the hook for that thing. I'm going to give the obligations and delegate what I can to little company A. They're the ones that should be paying for you. But if there's a breach or a default or something else like that, you may have a right to come back and get the money from me. That may be able to be necessary to get the deal done. Sometimes, the delegations may be as simple as, if you think about, I signed a contract with you to do A, B, and C. You're going to do plumbing, you're going to do electrical, and you're going to do drywall. And that's your contract with me. I'm a general contractor, you're a subcontractor that has three trades. Turns out you don't have enough drywallers. You may delegate your obligations under our contract to an outside company that's going to do drywall. If those outside third parties who have been delegated those obligations screw up, I'm still obligated for the screw-ups because I have delegated duties to them, but I'm still responsible for the work that's being performed. So that's the difference between delegation and assignment. Is you, the delegator, still is involved. Okay? What can be assigned or delegated? Personal duties normally cannot be assigned. I'm going to do a movie. I want Scarlett Johansson to be my leading actress. She signs a contract with her agent. Then ScarJo gets another contract, another movie that's a bigger movie, a better movie. She wants to do this. Or maybe she gets a small indie movie that she really thinks is really cool. And my agent, her agent calls up and says, hey, I have, I don't know, some other actors. She can do the thing. We're going to sign the contract, because she's a big star too. We're going to sign the contract to her, Felicity Jones, I don't know who else, somebody like that. Big deal, big contract, and you're saying, no, you cannot assign services. And the reason why comes in the basis from hundreds of years ago, the theory is that's really indentured servitude. You can't force someone to do a deal, you can't force someone else to take the deal with services. So you cannot typically assign services. Now, in the construction world, in the construction industry, services that are a profession, like I'm an architect, but I can assign some of my engineering design services with a subcontract to an engineer, to a civil engineer or electrical engineer or whatever. So there can be some assignment of those obligations. It's a little bit different. But I could come back and say, I don't want that electrical engineer. I want you. That's who I hired. So there's some nuances. But conceptually, you're not going to be assigning personal services. And they cannot be delegated. And that's what, I use that example like I said of a movie star or something like that, an athlete, you know, those types of services. Generic duties usually can be assigned. You know, I'm going to have somebody put up electrical work. I'm going to have, in the construction industry, I'm going to have an electrical engineer. Those aren't, while you may have a really good electrical engineer, you may have a really good carpenter or what have you, they're still considered generic. There's nothing specialized about it. It's not like the difference between, you know, ScarJo and somebody else, you know, somebody like that. So that's the difference between what can be assigned and delegated between services. Any questions?
Yeah, so like then within like our professional context, like you really like the idea of like assigning architectural work to another architect, it's like you might end up with a very different looking house.
Yeah, and I would argue that that's not assignable. I hired you because I liked your architecture. You know, you can't hire, you know, architect A and then architect B, like you're not getting that. So that, I would argue that's not an assignable contract. UVB, like you're like, oh my God, I'm so overwhelmed, I'm just going to assign it to my architect on the street, he's really good. That's not assignable. Question?
So then, like, in that example, if the hired architect, you design the house, could you contract an outside architect to do the drawings that you are designing?
You can. But that won't be an assignment. That'll be a delegation of duty, so you're still responsible. So if your contractor that you assign, or you delegate that work to and pay them for that, does it wrong, you're still on the hook. You can't just say, I'm going to take all responsibilities of drawing this and pass it over to Bob, and if Bob screws up, it's not my problem because it's Bob. Well, no, you were hired to do that. So, that help? Okay. Yes, very much so. Yeah, creative. You know, that's where you want to come into something that's why they were brought into the picture. You know, it's not going to be Tommy across the street cutting my lawn, but it may be somebody that I hire a specific one to do landscaping. So it's there's a specialized going up. You know, like there's a company that's near us that's called Chalet. Everybody loves them. I don't like them, but they're overpriced. But they're very well known for their landscaping. You can't contract for Chalet, and then Chalet gets the company down the street and says, well, I've signed the contract. They're going to come and do that. You hired them for that specific reason. So it's like I said. And the construction world becomes a little more generic in the concept of you're not assigning when you get these subcontracts. You're going to get a subcontract, but those are really a delegation of those duties to those parties. You're still on the hook because it's not assigned because it's not and you've lost you're out of the responsibility. Okay, last part. We only have like three more slides. Interpretation of contracts. So, what's the goal and the intent of the parties? That's what you want to find out. Like, let's say we've had all these talks about contracts. You've had all this, we've got a meeting of the minds, or do we have a meeting of the minds? We got this, we got that. And let's say we're dealing, well, maybe it's oral, maybe it's written, but how do we interpret what's in the writing? How do we understand it? Because we can't write every single thing. So, if you remember last week, we talked a little about the difference between the trier fact and the trier law. The jury is going to be listening to the facts, and they're going to be interpreting what the facts say, and they're going to come to a conclusion as to what those facts mean. That's the trier fact. The judge, or if it's been a bench trial, the judge is going to be both, the trier fact, trier law, but the judge is the trier law. The trier of law is going to tell the jury, if facts A, B, and C happen, the law says you must do this. Or, if A, C, and D happen, or Q, you must do that. They're going to tell you what those facts, as you put them together in the trier fact, they're going to tell you how you apply the law. So, when we're looking at the intent of the parties, when we're trying to understand what the contract means, it's the trier fact that looks to see what was the bargain. What rules to that monopoly game did we agree upon? You know, like, I'm trying to think of a board game where you can make some changes. You know, like, we have certain rules. You guys have heard of Uno? Okay, so we all know Uno. So, sometimes we have, when you get the pick two, you know that pick two card? Sometimes you have doubling. Do you know what that means? If the next person says pick two, it becomes four, and sometimes we don't do that. Sometimes it's pick two, and only a person picks two, so it only has one time. That's us changing the terms of the deal of what the rules are. Maybe it has them both, I don't know, maybe they're just, but we play sometimes doubling, sometimes we don't. I know this is really bizarre, it's like it would never happen, but let's say there's a big fight between my wife and I about what rules we were, the kids would be the trier of fact to say yes, we were doubling or no, we weren't. They are going to interpret what our deal was. That's what the trier fact does. And they're the ones that are going to interpret. What's that? Okay. Good. I'm glad to see. I guess if I think about it, sometimes we've had some rule discussions at our house over the board games we play from time to time. So the one is like, has anybody played Harry Potter Clue? Harry Potter's Clue is just like Clue, but each room on the four corner rooms, you can turn a wheel, and so it sometimes will close doors, and sometimes when you step in the room, it changes to what room you can get to, and sometimes you have to do certain potions. So, and then you have these other cards where you get, like you can get killed, but you can pay your way out, or you have like spells. So it's actually fun. But sometimes we have some discussions because my daughter's like between my daughter and my son are both big Harry Potter fans, but she's like really much more into it and much more knowledgeable about it. She's the one that has to interpret stuff. So I guess you're right. It's not that crazy. We do have that from time to time on game night. Okay. So that's what the trier fact is. Trier fact looks to determine what the actual bargain is. They like to listen to that. The court or the arbitrator. Arbitrator, remember we had last week, you could go litigation, which is in court, arbitration, you go to arbitration, an arbitrator or an arbiter, whatever you want to call it, they're like the judge. So the court, judge, jury, or the arbiter, panel, will not rewrite the contract. They're not going to say, well, this is what I think it means, because, you know, the court and the arbitrator will sometimes be, the court being the jury, the arbitrator, they will be the trier of facts. They can interpret what the deal was, what the bargain is, but they can't rewrite the contract, at least in most cases. There's something that we're going to talk about in a second, but we won't get into the detail of it, but it's what is in the written word. And the problem is that's when you get into the oral, is because you have to figure out what was the agreement, and that's what trier fact is. So sometimes it gets rewritten when it's oral, but you cannot, under the law, you cannot change what's in the writing. You just interpret it. So how do we do that? There's a couple levels of analysis. The first level is the objective language of the contract. What does it mean objectively, not subjectively? It says 3-bedroom, 3.5-bath house. There's no really, it's clear. So clear and unambiguous language is always enforced as written. Even if both parties say, that's not what the deal was. It was supposed to be three, we talked about it. It was supposed to be 3-bedroom, 3.5, or whatever. Like, you can make an argument that, no, this is what the contract is. Because one party may later say, no, we didn't agree to that. So there wasn't an oral modification. So clear and unambiguous language will always be enforced as written. No explanations or clarification to that language is permitted. You can't come in later and say, I told them this is what happened. Well, can you prove it? Do you have it in writing to show that they modified it? No, we had this discussion. We had this oral argument with this oral modification. I was told by Hanahan that we can orally modify a contract, and we did that. We agreed that it was going to be 3 bedrooms, 4 bathrooms, and I know we did that. And then you as the contractor or the architect say, no, we never had that agreement. My explanation, as legitimate as it may be, cannot be brought in. It can't be shown to change what the written contract is. I could even maybe potentially show I wrote a letter and say, hey, here's a letter that says I really want it to be a 4-bedroom, 4-bathroom house instead of 3.5. That may not be enough to change the written term. The court may say, did you guys agree with that? No, we never did. We got the letter, but we never came to a final agreement. We couldn't conclude on that, so we kept it in a 3.5-bath. Court will enforce the written terms of the signed contract as written. Okay? Why do we have this process? Why do we have to go through this first level? Well, it's simple. It's to resolve conflicts, because I'm going to be fighting with you. My house doesn't have enough bathrooms. Well, you aren't going to pay for that additional work. And then there's a conflict. There's a dispute. That's why we're in a lawsuit. So we have to have rules of how to interpret the contract. We have to have rules of figuring out what the monopoly board says. And so this is this first level, the objective perspective. Secondary level, which is not on here, but I will tell you about it. The secondary level is, and I'll get your question in a second, but the secondary level is when you start to look at what's called outside evidence. It's called parole evidence. I will never test you on this. I just want you to know this word, that it exists out there. A lot of lawyers don't even understand it. Parole evidence is that outside language where people are trying to show why the deal was different than internal. And sometimes it is allowed in very minor instances. So I'll give you an example. I had a case. It was a $10 million lawsuit. Well, the value was $10 million. They were suing us for $8 million. We were suing them for $2 million. They said we had $8 million in damages. We said we didn't cause any of those damages. And oh, by the way, you still owe us $2 million. So it was a $10 million gap. There was a provision in the contract that was not clear and unambiguous, but it had been discussed ad nauseum in previous drafts. And so we interpreted the contract A. This provision means A. That wasn't favorable for them, so they said the contract provision meant B. You look at the provision of the contract, it's not as clear as it A or B. The court needed to listen to testimony to interpret to see what it meant, but still the court had to enforce the contract as written. And so this concept of parole evidence, and again, I'm just telling you this is because it can come up, and this is why you want to be clear and careful with your drafting the contracts. We were able to submit evidence of prior drafts, of the notes that were taken, and the communications back and forth between the parties to show that the provision meant A. that was helpful for the court to interpret. That normally doesn't happen. There is often where I say A and I say B, and the courts enforce the language because it's clear and unambiguous. But when it's not as clear and unambiguous, then you can potentially bring in that parole evidence. But that's very rare. Most of the courts don't want to deal with that outside stuff because they want to see what's in writing is what's in writing so that it get overturned and appeals and stuff. So, okay. Last couple things here. I think this may be... Yeah, this is our last slide. Express terms are spelled out and they are written or oral. Remember we talked about at the very beginning, first slide, express contracts? They are spelled out. They are written in oral. We know what the deal is. That's an express term. Implied terms are part of the agreement, but not discussed and communicated. I know if I'm taking my dog to the vet, he's going to or she's going to do the best they can to help my dog, and I'm going to pay for that. That's an implied term. Industry, custom, and practice, an implied term. I'm going to work as a professional architect. I'm going to perform to the standard of care. Implied terms. So those are in there. They may not be written. They may not be communicated. But everybody knows I'm going to get a house that's not going to leak. Or I should get a house that doesn't leak. Or I should get a house that the floors don't warp or what have you. Those are implied terms. Express terms and implied terms are going to be in every contract you guys are going to do in this industry. Because everybody expects architects to do certain things, and you don't have to write them all down in contracts. So whether it's an oral agreement or a written agreement, there are going to be express terms and there's going to be implied terms. So you have to know that the concept of that, what they are. Some commonly implied, just a couple examples here, some commonly implied terms in construction contracts. Neither party will hinder the other from performing the contract. I'm not going to come as an owner on the project site. I'm not going to come and start telling your workers what to do. I don't like it this way. You're going to do it this way. Well, my contract is with the general contractor. They've hired a subcontractor. The general contractor is supposed to direct those subcontractors, not me. I'm not going to hinder that general contractor from doing their job. I'm not going to stop making payments to hinder the general contractor from doing the job. So that's something that is never really written in any contract, but you can't interfere with somebody else from doing their deal. So that's an implied term in the construction. Construction will be performed in a good and workmanlike manner. That good and workmanlike manner often is seen in a written contract. That's an industry custom. But if there's an oral agreement for you, like, hey, I want you to build a deck. I mean, like, we had a contractor build a backyard deck for us. I didn't have a written contract with him. He just put down on a piece of paper, I can do this for $5,000. They built my backyard deck. I had sketched it out because I had my architectural degree. I had the floor plans for my house that were given to me by the previous owner. And I sketched out a map, a drawing for them. I gave them dimensions. And I said, here, I want you to use this type of that plastic wood type looking thing for the planks. And I said, go buy it and do this. He gave me a price. That was it. There was no contract. But I expected him to put it in a good and workmanlike manner. I didn't have to write that down. That's implied in the construction industry. Or, for the architect side, an architect will perform his or her duties in accordance with the appropriate standard of care. You are going to design something for me that will stand up. It will pass code. It's not unsafe. It will be something that's visibly attractive. The plumbing design or the electrical design won't leak in the house or short out. Those are things that are considered part of your standard of care. That's implied whether it's written in the contract or not. Those are often going to be in every construction contract, no matter what, whether you said it or not. Any questions on that? Okay. As I said, I tried to get you guys out earlier. We're done. So that's it for today. Please help yourself with any more donuts if you want to take it on the way. And you guys have a nice weekend.